and she wasn't alone. Berkeley psychologist Christina Maslach, the pioneer of research on job burnout, reports that across occupational sectors, teaching has the highest rates of emotional exhaustion. One TFA teacher admires the organization, but says it is focused on hard work and dedication almost to a fault. You leave training with the mindset that unless you pour every waking hour of your life into the job, then you're doing a disservice to your kids. Of all TFA teachers, more than half leave after their 2-year contract is up, and more than 80% are gone after 3 years. About a third of all TFA alumni walk away from education altogether. Since givers tend to put others' interests ahead of their own, they often help others at the expense of their own well-being, placing themselves at risk for burnout. 4 decades of extensive research shows that when people become burned out, their job performance suffers. Exhausted employees struggle to focus their attention and lack the energy to work their hardest, longest, and smartest. So the quality and quantity of their work takes a nosedive. They also suffer from poor emotional and physical health. Strong evidence reveals that burned out employees are at heightened risk for depression, physical fatigue, sleep disruptions, impaired immune systems, alcohol abuse, and even cardiovascular disease. When Conray hit rock bottom at Overbrook High School, she felt that she was giving too much. She was arriving at work early, staying up late, and working weekends, and she could hardly keep up. In this situation, it seems that the natural way to recover and recharge would be to reduce her giving. But that wasn't what she did. Instead, Conray gave more. While maintaining her overwhelming teaching workload, Conray began volunteering her time as a TFA alumni mentor. As a content support specialist, every other week, she helped 10 different teachers create tests and design new lesson plans. Then, in her limited spare time, she founded a mentoring program. With 2 friends, she created a Philadelphia chapter of Minds Matter, a national nonprofit organization that helps high-achieving, low-income students prepare for college. Conray spent her nights and weekends filing for nonprofit status, finding a pro bono law firm and accountant, and applying for national approval. Finally, after a year, she was able to start recruiting students and mentors, and she created the plans for weekly sessions. From then on, Conray added 5 hours a week mentoring high school students. All told, Conray was spending more than 10 extra hours per week giving. This meant even less room in her schedule for relaxation or restorative downtime, and even more responsibility to others. And yet, when she started giving more, Conray's burnout faded, and her energy returned. Suddenly, in fact, she seemed to be a renewed bundle of energy at Overbrook, finding the strength to serve as the coordinator for gifted students and create a Spanish 3 program from scratch. Unlike many of her peers, she didn't quit. Of the 5 teachers who joined Overbrook from TFA with her, Conray was the only one still teaching there after 4 years. Of the dozen teachers who arrived in the same 3-year window as her, Conray was one of just 2 left. She became one of the rare TFA teachers who continued teaching for at least 4 years, and she was nominated for a National Teaching Award. How is it possible that giving more revitalized her instead of draining her? The Impact Vacuum. Givers Without a Cause. A decade ago, Howard Huebner, a dynamic director of a university call center, invited me to help him figure out how to maintain the motivation of his callers. The callers were charged with contacting university alumni and asking them to donate money. They were required to ask for donations 3 times before hanging up, and still faced a rejection rate exceeding 90%. Even the most seasoned and successful callers were burning out. As one experienced caller put it, "I found the calls I was making to be extremely difficult, Many of the prospects cut me off in my first couple of sentences and told me they were not interested in giving. I assumed that the takers were dropping like flies. They wouldn't be as committed as the givers. So during training, I measured whether each caller was a giver, matcher, or taker. In their first month on the job, the takers were bringing in an average of more than 30 donations a week. Contrary to my expectation, the givers were much less productive. They were struggling to maintain their motivation, making fewer calls and bringing in under 10 donations a week. I was mystified. Why were the callers who wanted to make a difference actually making the least difference? I got my answer one day when I paid a visit to the call center and noticed a sign one of the callers had posted above his desk. Doing a good job here is like wetting your pants in a dark suit. You get a warm feeling, but no one else notices. According to my data, the caller who proudly displayed this sign was a strong giver. Why would a giver feel unappreciated? In reflecting on this sign, I began to think that my initial assumption was correct after all. Based on the motivational structure of the job, the givers should be outpacing the takers. The problem was that the givers were being deprived of the rewards they find most energizing. The takers were motivated by the fact that they were working at the highest paying job on campus. But the givers lacked the rewards that mattered most to them. Whereas takers tend to care most about benefiting personally from their jobs, givers care deeply about doing jobs that benefit other people. When the callers brought in donations, most of the money went directly to student scholarships. But the callers were left in the dark. They had no idea who was receiving the money and how it affected their lives. At the next training session, I invited new callers to read letters from students whose scholarships had been funded by the callers' work. One scholarship student named Will wrote, "When it came down to making the decision, I discovered that the out-of-state tuition was quite expensive. But this university is in my blood. My grandparents met here. My dad and his four brothers all went here. I even owe my younger brother to this school. He was conceived the night we won the NCAA basketball tournament. All my life, I have dreamed of coming here. I was ecstatic to receive the scholarship, and I came to school ready to take full advantage of the opportunities it afforded me. The scholarship has improved my life in many ways." After reading the letters, it took the givers just a week to catch up to the takers. The takers did show some improvement, but the givers responded most powerfully, nearly tripling in weekly calls and donations. Now they had a stronger emotional grasp of their impact. If they brought in more money, they could help more scholarship students like Will. By spending just 5 minutes reading about how the job helped other people, the givers were motivated to achieve the same level of productivity as the takers. But the givers still weren't seeing the full impact of their jobs. Instead of reading letters, what if they actually met a scholarship recipient face-to-face? When callers interacted with one scholarship recipient in person, they were even more energized. The average caller doubled in calls per hour and minutes on the phone per week. By working harder, the callers reached more alumni, resulting in 144% more alumni donating each week. Even more strikingly, revenue quintupled. Callers averaged $412 before meeting the scholarship recipient and more than $2,000 afterward. One caller soared from averages of 5 calls and $100 per shift to 19 calls and $2,615 per shift. Several control groups of callers who didn't meet a scholarship recipient showed no changes in calls, phone time, donations, or revenue. Overall, just 5 minutes interacting with one scholarship recipient motivated 23 callers to raise an extra $38,451 for the university in a single week. Although the givers, takers, and matchers were all motivated by meeting the scholarship recipient, the gains in effort and revenue were especially pronounced among the givers. The turnaround highlights a remarkable principle of giver burnout. It has less to do with the amount of giving and more with the amount of feedback from the impact of that giving. Researchers have drawn the same conclusion in healthcare, where burnout is often described as compassion fatigue, the stress, strain, and weariness of caring for others. Originally, experts believed that compassion fatigue was caused by expressing too much compassion. But new research has challenged this conclusion. As researchers Olga Klemecki and Tanya Singer summarize, more than all other factors, including the time spent caregiving, it is the perceived suffering that leads to depressive symptoms in the caregiver. Givers don't burn out when they devote too much time and energy to giving. They burn out when they're working with people in need but are unable to help effectively. Teachers are vulnerable to giver burnout because of the unique temporal experience that defines education. Even though teachers interact with their students on a daily basis, it can take many years for their impact to sink in. By then, students have moved on, and teachers are left wondering, did my work actually matter? With no clear affirmation of the benefits of their giving, the effort becomes more exhausting and harder to sustain. These challenges are pervasive in a setting like Overbrook, where teachers must fight many distractions and disadvantages to stimulate the attention, let alone attendance, of students. When Conray Callahan was emotionally exhausted, it wasn't because she was giving too much. It was because she didn't feel her giving was making a difference. In teaching, do I have an impact? It's kind of dicey, Conray told me. I often feel like I'm not doing anything effective, that I'm wasting my time, and I'm not making a difference. When Conray launched Minds Matter Philadelphia, she may have been bulking up her schedule, but the net effect was to fill the impact vacuum that she experienced in her teaching job at Overbrook. With my mentoring program, there's no doubt, I know that I have a more direct impact, she says. By mentoring low-income students who are high achievers, she felt able to make more of a difference than in her Overbrook classroom, where each student presented specific challenges. When she mentored high-achieving students, the positive feedback came more rapidly and validated her effort. She watched one mentee, David, blossom from a shy, reserved loner into an outspoken young man with a close group of friends. As with the fundraising callers meeting a scholarship student who benefited from their work, seeing the impact of her program had an energizing effect. But that effect wasn't limited to the mentoring program. Thanks to the energy boost, Conray developed renewed hope that she could have an impact in her job at Overbrook. Observing the progress of her high-achieving mentees instilled confidence that she could help the students struggling in her own classroom. I know what I've started is really making a difference with these kids. What I've seen in 3 months is a big change for them, and they make me realize how great kids can be. As she spent more time mentoring students at Minds Matter, she walked into her Overbrook classroom with greater enthusiasm, fueled by a revitalized sense of purpose. In research with two colleagues, I've discovered that the perception of impact serves as a buffer against stress, enabling employees to avoid burnout and maintain their motivation and performance. In one study, a student and I found that high school teachers who perceived their jobs as stressful and demanding reported significantly greater burnout. But upon closer inspection, job stress was only linked to higher burnout for teachers who felt they didn't make a difference. A sense of lasting impact protected against stress, preventing exhaustion. In the classroom, it sometimes takes years for a teacher's lesson to hit home with students. By that time, many teachers have lost contact with their students. But at least for a while, teachers have the opportunity to see their short-term impact as they interact face-to-face with their students. Many other jobs provide no contact at all with the people who benefit from our work. In healthcare, for example, many medical professionals provide critical diagnoses without ever meeting the patients on the other end of their test results. In Israel, a group of radiologists evaluated nearly 100 computed tomography, CT, exams from patients. After 3 months passed, the radiologists had forgotten the original CT exams, and they evaluated them again. Some of the radiologists got better, showing 53% improvement in detecting abnormalities unrelated to the primary reason for the exams. But other radiologists got worse. Their accuracy dropped by 28% on the exact same CT exams in just 3 months. Why did some radiologists get better, while others got worse? Their patients had been photographed before their exams. Half of the radiologists completed their first CT exams without a patient's photo. When they did their second CT exams 3 months later, they saw the photo. These were the radiologists who improved by 53%. The other half of the radiologists saw the patient photo in their first CT exams and then completed their second CT exams 3 months later with no photo. These were the radiologists who deteriorated by 28%. Attaching a single patient's photo to a CT exam increased diagnostic accuracy by 46%. And roughly 80% of the key diagnostic findings came only when the radiologists saw the patient's photo. The radiologist missed these important findings when the photo was absent, even if they caught them 3 months earlier. When the radiologist saw the patient's photo, they felt more empathy. By encouraging empathy, the photos motivated the radiologists to conduct their diagnoses more carefully. Their reports were 29% longer when the CT exams included patient photos. When the radiologist saw a photo of a patient, they felt a stronger connection to the human impact of their work. A patient photo makes each CT scan unique, said one radiologist. In a recent study, researcher Nicola Bellet found similar patterns in a study of 90 Italian nurses who were invited to assemble surgical kits. After being randomly assigned to meet healthcare practitioners who would use the kits, nurses were significantly more productive and more accurate. This effect was particularly pronounced among nurses who had reported strong giver tendencies in a survey. Interestingly, a week after meeting the healthcare practitioners who benefited from the surgical kits, all of the nurses actually felt more inclined toward giving. Along with reducing burnout among givers, a first-hand connection to impact can tilt people of all reciprocity styles in the giver direction. When people know how their work makes a difference, they feel energized to contribute more. Building on this idea that seeing impact can reduce the burnout of givers and motivate others to give, some organizations have designed initiatives to connect employees to the impact of their products and services. At Wells Fargo, a vice president named Ben Sikorsky created videos of customers talking about how the company's low-interest loans helped them reduce and eliminate their unwanted debt. In many cases, customers felt like they had a massive weight lifted off their shoulders. They now had a plan for paying down their debt, Sikorsky says. When bankers watched the videos, it was like a light switch turned on. Bankers realized the impact their work could have, that this loan could really make a difference in customers' lives. It was a really compelling motivator. At Medtronic, employees across the company, from engineers to salespeople, pay visits to hospitals to see their medical technologies benefiting patients. When they're exhausted, former Medtronic CEO Bill George told me, It's very important that they get out there and see procedures. They can see their impact on patients, which reminds them that they're here to restore people to full life and health. Medtronic also holds an annual party for the entire company, more than 30,000 employees, at which 6 patients are invited to share their stories about how the company's products have changed their lives. When they see for the first time how much their work can matter, many employees break down into tears. Having a greater impact is one of the reasons why, counterintuitive as it might seem, giving more can actually help givers avoid burnout. But it's not the whole story. There's a second reason why Conray's extra giving was energizing, and it has to do with where and to whom she gave. Nearly a century ago, the psychologist Anitra Karsten invited people to work on repetitive tasks for as long as they enjoyed them, but to stop when they were tired. For long periods of time, the participants toiled away at tasks like drawing pictures and reading poems aloud, until they couldn't handle it any longer. One man's task was to write Abbabab over and over. As the Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer retells it, he went on until he was mentally and physically exhausted. His hand felt numb, as though it couldn't move to make even one more mark. At that moment, the investigator asked him to sign his name and address for a different purpose. He did so quite easily. The same strange thing happened to other participants. One woman said she was so drained that she couldn't lift her arm to make another mark. But she then lifted her arm to adjust her hair, apparently without any difficulty or discomfort. And when participants read poems aloud until their voices were hoarse, they had no trouble complaining about the task. And when they complained, they didn't sound hoarse anymore. According to Langer, they weren't faking it. Rather, the change of context brought renewed energy. When Conray volunteered as a mentor to TFA teachers, it created a change of context that made giving feel fresh. Working with adults, doing something that is kind of teaching, that doesn't burn me out. That invigorates me, Conray says. Giving more can be exhausting if it's in the same domain. Instead of giving more in the same way, over and over, she expanded her contributions to a different group of people. The same thing happened when she started mentoring high school students at Minds Matter. She had a new setting and a new group of people to help. Instead of teaching them Spanish, she was getting them ready for college. By shifting her giving to a novel domain, she was able to recharge her energy. Otherish choices. Chunking, sprinkling, and the 100-hour rule of volunteering. We discussed otherish behavior at the beginning of this chapter, and in both Conray's example and that of the fundraising callers, the distinction between selfless givers and otherish givers begins to come into play. In these contexts, decisions about how, where, and how much to give clearly make a difference when it comes to burning out or firing up. It might seem that by giving more, Conray was being selfless. But what she actually did was create an opportunity for giving that was also personally rewarding, drawing energy from the visible impact of her contributions. To be more selfless, in this case, would have meant giving even more at school, where endless help was needed, but where she felt limited in her ability to make a difference. Instead, Conray thought more about her own well-being and found a way to improve it by giving in a new way. That choice has real consequences for givers. In numerous studies, Carnegie Mellon psychologist Vicki Helgeson has found that when people give continually without concern for their own well-being, they're at risk for poor mental and physical health. Yet when they give in a more otherish fashion, demonstrating substantial concern for themselves as well as others, They no longer experience health costs. In one study, people who maintained equilibrium between benefiting themselves and others even achieved significant increases in happiness and life satisfaction over a 6-month period. To gain a deeper understanding of otherish and selfless givers, it's worth looking more closely at the decisions they make about when and how much to give. It turns out that Conray's giving helped her avoid burnout not only due to the variety, but also because of how she planned it. Imagine that you're going to perform 5 random acts of kindness this week. You'll be doing things like helping a friend with a project, writing a thank you note to a former teacher, donating blood, and visiting an elderly relative. You can choose one of 2 different ways to organize your giving: chunking or sprinkling. If you're a chunker, you'll pack all 5 acts of giving into a single day each week. If you're a sprinkler, you'll distribute your giving evenly across 5 different days so that you give a little bit each day. Which do you think would make you happier, chunking or sprinkling? In this study, led by the psychologist Sonia Lyubomirsky, people performed 5 random acts of kindness every week for 6 weeks. They were randomly divided into 2 groups. Half chunked their giving into a single day each week, and the other half sprinkled it across all 5 days each week. At the end of the 6 weeks, despite performing the same number of helping acts, only one group felt significantly happier. The chunkers achieved gains in happiness. The sprinklers didn't. Happiness increased when people performed all 5 giving acts in a single day, rather than doing 1 a day. Lyubomirsky and colleagues speculate that spreading them over the course of a week might have diminished their salience and power, or made them less distinguishable from participants' habitual kind behavior. Like the participants who became happier, Conray was a chunker. At Minds Matter, Conray packed her volunteering into 1 day a week, giving all 5 weekly hours of mentoring high school students on Saturdays. By chunking her giving into weekly blocks, she was able to experience her impact more vividly, leading her efforts to feel like more than a drop in the bucket. Chunking giving is an otherish strategy. Instead of mentoring students after school, when she was already exhausted, Conray reserved it for the weekend, when her energy was recharged and it was more convenient in her schedule. In contrast, selfless givers are more inclined to sprinkle their giving throughout their days, helping whenever people need them. This can become highly distracting and exhausting, robbing selfless givers of the attention and energy necessary to complete their own work. One September, 17 software engineers at a Fortune 500 company were charged with developing code for a major new product. It was a color laser printer that would sell for 10% of the cost of other products on the market. If it succeeded, the company would be a dominant player in the market and could release an entire family of products to follow the printer. The division was losing money rapidly, and if the printer wasn't ready on time, the division would fold. To finish the project, the engineers were working nights and weekends, but they were still behind schedule. The odds were against them. Only once in the division's history had a product been launched on time. They were stressed and exhausted, writes Harvard professor Leslie Perlow, with insufficient time to meet all the demands on them. The engineers had fallen into a pattern of selfless giving. They were constantly helping their colleagues solve problems. One engineer reported that, "The biggest frustration of my job is always having to help others and not getting my own work done." Another lamented that, "The problem with my work style is that responsiveness breeds more need for responsiveness, and I'm so busy responding, I cannot get my own work done." On a typical day, an engineer named Andy worked from 8 o'clock a.m. until 8:15 p.m. It wasn't until after 5 p.m. that Andy found a block of time longer than 20 minutes to work on his core task. In the hopes of carving out time to get their own work done, engineers like Andy began arriving at work early in the morning and staying late at night. This was a short-lived solution. As more engineers burned the midnight oil, the interruptions occurred around the clock. The engineers were giving more time without making more progress, and it was exhausting. Perlo had an idea for turning these selfless givers into otherish givers. She proposed that instead of sprinkling their giving, they could chunk it. She worked with the engineers to create dedicated windows for quiet time and interaction time. After experimenting with several different schedules, Perlo settled on holding quiet time 3 days a week, starting in the morning and lasting until noon. During quiet time, the engineers worked alone, and their colleagues knew to avoid interrupting them. The rest of the time, colleagues were free to seek help and advice. When Perlo polled the engineers about quiet time, 2/3 reported above average productivity. When Perlo stepped back and left it to the engineers to manage their own quiet time for a full month, 47% maintained above average productivity. By chunking their helping time, the engineers were able to conserve time and energy to complete their own work, making a transition from selfless to otherish giving. In the words of one engineer, quiet time enabled me to do some of the activities during the day which I would have normally deferred to late evening. After 3 months, the engineers launched the laser printer on time for only the second time in division history. The vice president of the division chalked the success up to the giving boundaries created by quiet time. I do not think we could have made the deadline without this project. Since the engineers were facing an urgent need to finish their product on time, they had a strong justification for making their giving more otherish. But in many situations, the appropriate boundaries for giving time are much murkier. Sean Haggerty is a principal in investment management at Vanguard, a financial services company that specializes in mutual funds. Sean is a dedicated mentor with a long-standing passion for education, and he has made a habit of volunteering his time at least a week each year to teach employees at Vanguard's corporate university. When Vanguard's chief learning officer counted his hours, she noticed that Sean was spending a large amount of time in the classroom. She was worried that he would burn out, and Sean recognized that he might be at risk. "It's a pretty significant commitment given that I have a day job." But instead of scaling back his hours, Sean asked for more. "It's among the most valuable things that I do." The more hours he volunteered teaching, the more energized he felt, until he approached 2 weeks and cleared 100 hours of annual volunteering on educational initiatives. 100 seems to be a magic number when it comes to giving. In a study of more than 2,000 Australian adults in their mid-60s, those who volunteered between 100 and 800 hours per year were happier and more satisfied with their lives than those who volunteered fewer than 100 or more than 800 hours annually. In another study, American adults who volunteered at least 100 hours in 1998 were more likely to be alive in 2000. There were no benefits of volunteering more than 100 hours. This is the 100-hour rule of volunteering. It appears to be the range where giving is maximally energizing and minimally draining. 100 hours a year breaks down to just 2 hours a week. Research shows that if people start volunteering 2 hours a week, their happiness, satisfaction, and self-esteem go up a year later. 2 hours a week in a fresh domain appears to be the sweet spot where people make a meaningful difference without being overwhelmed or sacrificing other priorities. It's also the range in which volunteering is most likely to strike a healthy balance, offering benefits to the volunteer as well as the recipients. In a national study, several thousand Canadians reported the number of hours that they volunteered per year, and whether they gained new technical, social, or organizational knowledge and skills from volunteering. For the first few hours a week, volunteers gained knowledge and skills at a consistent rate. By 5 hours a week, volunteering had diminishing returns. People were learning less and less with each additional hour. After 11 hours a week, additional time volunteered no longer added new knowledge and skills. When Conray started volunteering as an alumni mentor for TFA, she was giving about 75 hours a year. When she launched Minds Matter, the nonprofit mentoring program for high school students, she sailed over the 100-hour mark. Perhaps it's not a coincidence that her energy was restored right around that point. But it wasn't just the amount of time that mattered. There's another form of chunking in Conray's giving that's also apparent in Sean Haggerty's giving, and it reveals a key contrast between selfless and otherish giving. As Sean Haggerty spent more time teaching in the Vanguard classroom, he began to crave more opportunities for giving. "I want to leave the place better than I entered it, in my small way," he says, and he began asking himself how he could have an impact on the world. As he reflected on different ways of giving, he noticed a pattern in how he was spending his free time. "I found myself reading more and more about education. I had a natural passion for it." Sean decided to lead and launch two new programs around education. One program is called The Classroom Economy, and it has a national focus. Sean and his colleagues teach the basics of money management to kindergartners around the United States. The other program, Team Vanguard, is local. Sean has partnered with a charter school in Philadelphia to administer a 4-year mentoring program where employees volunteer their time on evenings, weekends, and lunch breaks. Despite the substantial time commitment, Sean found that both programs have a tremendously positive impact on my energy. "It's the selling point I have with senior staff who worry about volunteer hours, which take time out of the day. It does sometimes, but my point of view is that it creates a much more highly engaged employee, including me. I love that work is giving me an outlet for philanthropic interests." If Sean were a purely selfless giver, he might sprinkle his energy across many different causes out of a sense of duty and obligation, regardless of his own level of interest and enthusiasm for them. Instead, he adopts an otherish approach, choosing to chunk his giving to focus on education, a cause about which he's passionate. "I get incredible personal satisfaction out of giving back to the community in this way," Sean says. Psychologists Netta Weinstein and Richard Ryan have demonstrated that giving has an energizing effect only if it's an enjoyable, meaningful choice, rather than undertaken out of duty and obligation. In one study, people reported their giving every day for 2 weeks, indicating whether they had helped someone or done something for a good cause. On days when they gave, they rated why they gave. On some days, people gave due to enjoyment and meaning. They thought it was important, cared about the other person, and felt they might enjoy it. On other days, they gave out of duty and obligation. They felt they had to and would feel like a bad person if they didn't. Each day, they reported how energized they felt. Weinstein and Ryan measured changes in energy from day to day. Giving itself didn't affect energy. People weren't substantially happier on days when they helped others than on days that they didn't. But the reasons for giving mattered immensely. On days that people helped others out of a sense of enjoyment and purpose, they experienced significant gains in energy. Giving for these reasons conferred a greater sense of autonomy, mastery, and connection to others, and it boosted their energy. When I studied firefighters and fundraising callers, I found the same pattern. They were able to work much harder and longer when they gave their energy and time due to a sense of enjoyment and purpose rather than duty and obligation. For Conray, this is a major difference between teaching at Overbrook and volunteering with Minds Matter and TFA. In the Overbrook classroom, giving is an obligation. Her job requires her to break up fights and maintain order, tasks that, although important, don't align with the passion that drew her into teaching. In her volunteer work, giving is an enjoyable choice. She loves helping high-achieving, underprivileged students and mentoring less experienced TFA teachers. This is another way giving can be otherish. Conray focused on benefiting students and teachers, but doing so in a way that connects to her core values and fuels her enthusiasm. The energy carried over to her classroom, helping her maintain her motivation. But at Overbrook, Conray couldn't avoid the obligation to give to her students in ways that she didn't find naturally exciting or energizing. What did she do to stay energized, despite the sense of duty? During one particularly stressful week, Conray was struggling to get through to her students. "I was feeling miserable, and the kids were being awful." She approached a teacher named Sarah for help. Sarah recommended an activity that was a hit in her classroom. They got to design their own monsters that were on the loose in Philadelphia. They drew a picture of a monster, wrote a story about it, and created a wanted ad so people would be on the lookout. It was exactly the inspiration that Conray needed. "Our 10-minute chat helped me get excited about the lesson. I had fun with the kids, and it made me more invested in the curriculum I was teaching." Although Conray's decision to ask another teacher for help may not sound unusual, research shows that it's quite rare among selfless givers. "Selfless givers feel uncomfortable receiving support," write Helgeson and colleague Heidi Fritz. "Selfless givers are determined to be in the helper role, so they're reluctant to burden or inconvenience others." Helgeson and Fritz find that selfless givers receive far less support than otherish givers, which proves psychologically and physically costly. As burnout expert Christina Maslach and colleagues conclude, there is now a consistent and strong body of evidence that a lack of social support is linked to burnout. In contrast, otherish givers recognize the importance of protecting their own well-being. When they're on the brink of burnout, otherish givers seek help, which enables them to marshal the advice, assistance, and resources necessary to maintain their motivation and energy. 3 decades of research show that receiving support from colleagues is a robust antidote to burnout. "Having a support network of teachers is huge," Conray affirms. But Overbrook didn't have a formal support network of teachers. So where did Conray get her support network? She built one at Overbrook through the act of giving help. For many years, experts believed that the stress response involved a choice, fight or flight. Since burnout means we lack the energy to fight, it's natural to choose flight, coping by avoiding the source of stress. Burnout experts Jonathan Halbesleben and Matthew Bowler studied professional firefighters over a 2-year period. Sure enough, when the firefighters started to burn out, their performance ratings dropped. Burnout made them less concerned about achievement and status. Consequently, they invested less effort in their work, and their effectiveness suffered. But surprisingly, in this study, burnout didn't decrease effort across the board. There was one place where firefighters actually increased their effort when they felt burned out: helping others. When the firefighters experienced signs of burnout, they were more likely to go out of their way to help colleagues with heavy workloads, share new knowledge with supervisors, give advice to newer colleagues, and even listen to colleagues' problems. Why would burnout increase their giving? UCLA psychologist Shelley Taylor has discovered a stress response that differs from fight or flight. She calls it tend and befriend. One of the most striking aspects of the human stress response is the tendency to affiliate, that is, to come together in groups to provide and receive joint protection in threatening times. Taylor's neuroscience research reveals that when we feel stressed, the brain's natural response is to release chemicals that drive us to bond. This is what the firefighters did. When they started to feel exhausted, they invested their limited energy in helping their colleagues. Intuitively, they recognized that giving would strengthen their relationships and build support, at least from matchers and givers. Although most givers are aware of this opportunity, it appears that only otherish givers actually take advantage of it. Conray Callahan built her support network by tending and befriending under stress. When she was at the pinnacle of exhaustion, she started mentoring TFA teachers and several of the younger teachers in her own school. One of the teachers Conray mentored was Sarah. In the course of mentoring, one of the exercises that Conray taught Sarah was the monster activity. Conray had forgotten about it, and when she reached out for help, Sarah reminded her about it. The advice itself was helpful, but it also strengthened Conray's sense of impact. She had given Sarah an activity that was a big hit with her own students. Otherish givers build up a support network that they can access for help when they need it. This, along with chunking giving so that it's energizing, is what makes otherish givers less vulnerable to burnout than selfless givers. But how do otherish givers stack up against takers and matchers? The myth of giver burnout. Years ago, Dutch psychologists studied hundreds of health professionals. They tracked the amount of time and energy that the health professionals gave to patients and asked them to report how burned out they felt. A year later, the psychologist measured giving and burnout again. Sure enough, the more the health professionals gave, the more burned out they became in the following year. Those who gave selflessly had the highest burnout rates. They contributed far more than they got, and it exhausted them. Those who acted like matchers and takers were far less burned out. But strangely, in another study, the Dutch psychologists found evidence that some healthcare professionals seemed immune to burnout. Even when they gave a great deal of time and energy, they didn't exhaust themselves. These resilient healthcare professionals were otherish givers. They reported that they enjoyed helping other people and often went out of their way to do so, but weren't afraid to seek help when they needed it. The otherish givers had significantly lower burnout rates than the matchers and takers, who lacked the stamina to keep contributing. This study pointed to an unexpected possibility. Although matchers and takers appear to be less vulnerable to burnout than selfless givers, the greatest resilience may belong to otherish givers. Part of the reason for this is illuminated in fascinating work by Northwestern University psychologists Elizabeth Seeley and Wendy Gardner, who asked people to work on a difficult task that sapped their willpower. For example, imagine that you're very hungry, and you're staring at a plate of delicious chocolate chip cookies, but you have to resist the temptation to eat them. After using up their willpower in a task like this, Participants squeezed a hand grip as long as they could. The typical participant was able to hold on for 25 seconds. But there was a group of people who were able to hold on 40% longer, lasting for 35 seconds. The participants with unusually high stamina scored high on a questionnaire measuring other-directedness. These other-directed people operated like givers. By consistently overriding their selfish impulses in order to help others, they had strengthened their psychological muscles to the point where using willpower for painful tasks was no longer exhausting. In support of this idea, other studies have shown that givers accrue an advantage in controlling their thoughts, emotions, and behaviors. Over time, giving may build willpower, like weightlifting builds muscles. Of course, we all know that when muscles are overused, they fatigue, and sometimes even tear. This is what happens to selfless givers. In Utah, a 75-year-old man understands the resilience of otherish givers. His name is John Huntsman Sr., and his tiny photo from his company's annual report, mentioned in Chapter 2, in juxtaposition with the full-size photo of Kenneth Lay, mentioned earlier. You might also recognize him as the father of former Utah governor and 2012 Republican presidential candidate John Huntsman Jr. Back in 1990, the elder Huntsman was negotiating an acquisition with Charles Miller Smith, who was the president and CEO of a chemical company. During the negotiations, Smith's wife died. Huntsman empathized with Smith, so he decided not to push any further. "I decided the fine points of the last 20% of the deal would stand as they were proposed. I probably could have clawed another $200 million out of the deal, but it would have come at the expense of Charles's emotional state. The agreement, as it stood, was good enough." Was a CEO's emotional state really worth $200 million to Huntsman? Believe it or not, this wasn't the first time Huntsman gave away a fortune during a negotiation. Just 4 years earlier, in 1986, he made a verbal agreement with a CEO named Emerson Campin. Huntsman would sell 40% of a division of his company to Campin's for $54 million. Due to legal delays, the contract wasn't written until 6 months later. By that time, Huntsman's profits had skyrocketed. That 40% of the division was now worth $250 million. Campin called with a matcher's offer to split the difference, proposing to pay $152 million instead of the original $54 million. Huntsman was poised to bring in nearly triple the original agreement, but he said no. The $54 million was good enough. Campin was incredulous. "That's not fair to you." Huntsman believed in honoring his commitment to Campin. Even though the lawyers hadn't drafted the original purchase agreement, he had shaken hands 6 months earlier on a verbal agreement. He signed for the $54 million, walking away from an extra $98 million. What type of businessman would make such irrational decisions? In 1970, Huntsman started a chemical company that reigns today as the world's largest. He has been named Entrepreneur of the Year and earned more than a dozen honorary doctorates from universities around the world. He's a billionaire, one of the Forbes 1,000 richest people in the world. As his deal-making choices show, Huntsman is also a giver, and not just in business. Since 1985, he has been involved in serious philanthropy. He is one of just 19 people in the world who have given at least $1 billion away. Huntsman has won major humanitarian awards for giving more than $350 million to found the world-class Huntsman Cancer Center and made hefty donations to help earthquake victims in Armenia, support education, and fight domestic violence and homelessness. Of course, many rich people give away serious sums of money, but Huntsman demonstrates an uncommon intensity that sets him apart. In 2001, the chemical industry tanked, and he lost a sizable portion of his fortune. Most people would cut back on giving until they recovered. But Huntsman made an unconventional decision. He took out a personal loan, borrowing several million dollars to make good on his philanthropic commitments for the next 3 years. Huntsman sounds like a classic example of someone who got rich and then decided to give back. But there's a different way of looking at Huntsman's success, one that might be impossible to believe if it weren't backed up by Huntsman's experience and by science. Maybe getting rich didn't turn him into a giver. What if we've mixed up cause and effect? Huntsman believes that being a giver actually made him rich. In his giving pledge, Huntsman writes, "It has been clear to me since my earliest childhood memories that my reason for being was to help others. The desire to give back was the impetus for pursuing an education in business, for applying that education to founding what became a successful container company, and for using that experience to grow our Differentiated Chemicals Corporation." As early as 1962, Huntsman told his wife that he wanted to start his own business so he could make a difference for people with cancer. Huntsman lost both of his parents to cancer and had survived 3 bouts of cancer himself. Curing cancer is so deeply ingrained in Huntsman's fiber that he has even prioritized it above his political ideology. Although he worked in the Nixon White House and has been a longtime supporter of the Republican Party, Huntsman has been known to favor Democratic candidates if they demonstrate a stronger commitment to curing cancer. There's little doubt that Huntsman is a skilled businessman. But the very act of giving away money might have contributed to his fortune. In Winners Never Cheat, he writes, "Monetarily, the most satisfying moments in my life have not been the excitement of closing a great deal or reaping the profits from it. They have been when I was able to help others in need. There's no denying that I'm a deal junkie, but I also have developed an addiction for giving. The more one gives, the better one feels, and the better one feels about it, the easier it becomes to give." This is an extension of the idea that otherish givers build willpower muscles, making it easy to give more. But is it possible that Huntsman actually made money by giving it away? Remarkably, there's evidence to support this claim. The economist Arthur Brooks tested the relationship between income and charitable giving. Using data from almost 30,000 Americans in the year 2000, he controlled for every factor imaginable that would affect income and giving. He adjusted for education, age, race, religious involvement, political beliefs, and marital status. He also accounted for the number of times people volunteered. As expected, higher income led to higher giving. For every $1 in extra income, charitable giving went up by 14 cents. But something much more interesting happened. For every $1 in extra charitable giving, income was $3.75 higher. Giving actually seemed to make people richer. For example, imagine that you and I are both earning $60,000 a year. I give $1,600 to charity. You give $2,500 to charity. Although you gave away $900 more than I did, according to the evidence, you'll be on track to earn $3,375 more than I will in the coming year. Surprising as it seems, people who give more go on to earn more. John Huntsman Sr. may be on to something. Research shows that giving can boost happiness and meaning, motivating people to work harder and earn more money, even if the gift isn't on the colossal scale of Huntsman's. In a study by psychologists Elizabeth Dunn, Laura Acknon, and Michael Norton, people rated their happiness in the morning. Then they received a windfall, an envelope with $20. They had to spend it by 5.